This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. Written and narrated for you by Michael J. Fox. For Stephen, Gary, Nancy, and Bob, gratitude. Introduction, Fall Guy. August 13th, 2018, 6:30 a.m. I'm going down. It's a flash fall, vertical to horizontal in a blink. I twist my head to save my face from collision with the kitchen tile. What the hell just happened? I rise up on my right elbow, expecting to shift my weight to my left and push up onto my feet. Surprise, I can't feel my left arm. As my shock subsides, it's clear that I need help. Slithering forward on my belly toward the wall-mounted phone, I am a one-armed commando, crawling under the table, across the floor and through a thicket of chair legs, dragging a sandbag of a left arm that remains unresponsive and unavailable. After 30 years of Parkinson's, I've established a sort of detente with the disease. We've had a history together. I've long realized the control is out of the question. Instead, I've settled for an understanding that requires adaptability and resilience. PD is like the persistent and cutting jab of a boxer. Manageable if I'm willing to do a little feinting and weaving. But then came the check hook, the blow that put me on my knees for a while. Unrelated to PD, a tumor had been found high in my spinal cord. The mass was benign, but constricting and well on its way to leaving me paralyzed. Menacing all on its own, the defect necessitated high-risk surgery, which was completed just 4 months prior to this moment on the kitchen floor. Through the crucible of recovery and rehabilitation, I have gone from wheelchair, to walker, to cane, to at last walking. And then this happened. The day before the accident, I flew back to Manhattan from Martha's Vineyard, in the middle of our summer vacation. Tracy was concerned about me staying in New York by myself. I was still what we would both describe as a little wobbly on my feet. But I'd been asked to do a one-day cameo in a Spike Lee-produced movie up in the Bronx, and it offered a brief window of independence. I'll be back in 2 days, I promised. Save me a lobster. Skylar, one of our 25-year-old twin daughters, also needed to head back to the city for work, so we traveled home together. She lingered with me for dinner, takeout pasta at the kitchen table. Polishing off the last forkful, she had a question. How do you feel about going back to work? I don't know, I guess I feel normal again. But are you nervous, dude? All my kids call me that, not dude, D-O-O-D. I flashed a confident smile. Hey, it's my job, it's what I do. She offered to stay over in her old room in case I needed her to fix breakfast in the morning to help me get organized before leaving for the set. Skeeter, I love you, I've done this a million times. Go back to your apartment, get some rest, I'll be fine. Okay, she said, but promise me you won't. I finished her sentence. Walk with my cell phone. She smiled. It was a gentle reprimand, and deserved. I am an expert at walking and chewing gum at the same time, but the consensus is that I'm incapable of doing it safely with a phone in my hand. It wreaks havoc with my coordination. You got it. I hugged her goodnight and watched the elevator doors close. For the first time in months, I was alone. Whatever it was that brought me down, it brought me down hard and in a hurry. I have fallen, and like that pitiable older woman splayed at the foot of the staircase next to an upended laundry basket, I can't get up. I have a theory about pain. If an injury hurts immediately, I know for sure it's benign. But pain that intensifies after a few minutes is reporting real damage. And now, here comes the pain. A tiny transfer of weight to my left summons two revelations. One, a sleeve of hurt rockets down my useless arm. And two, I realize that my cell phone is in my pocket. I slipped it into the back of my sweatpants before I came into the kitchen. Note to Skylar, it wasn't in my hand. My first instinct is to call Tracy, but she's 5 hours away in Martha's Vineyard, and I don't want to freak her out. Instead, I call my assistant Nina, who jumps in a taxi and is on her way within minutes. Oddly, I think of Jimmy Cagney, of all people. He once sent me a note on the first day of a new movie. Be on time. Know your lines. and don't bump into the furniture. This morning I was on schedule and I knew my two pages of dialogue, but the third point was a colossal fail. While I wait for Nina, I slump on the kitchen floor, pissed off, my misery multiplying exponentially. I try to make sense out of this shit show, but none of my all-purpose bromides and affirmations serve the moment. There's no spinning this. This is just pain and regret. There's no finding the positive and moving on to the next circumstance life has to offer. I feel something beyond frustration and anger, something akin to shame, embarrassment. Every day since the spinal cord surgery in April, everyone, doctors, family members, and friends, have repeated this message to me over and over. You have one job, don't fall. Yet here I am. This incident on the kitchen floor brings me down in more ways than one. It isn't just that I'm hurt. I've been hurt many times. I've been through a lot, suffered the slings and arrows. But for some reason, this just feels personal. Make lemons into lemonade? Screw it. I'm out of the lemonade business. Chapter 1. Family Man. Sam is the only one of our children born before my Parkinson's diagnosis. I'm sure he has no memories in that context. He probably wasn't even aware. I did the basic dad stuff. Caught frogs at the pond, tagged along to the Mommy and Me music classes with the Orff instruments and the super serious nannies. I tried to interest him in team sports, which was a no-go. Too much arguing. I showed Sam how to tie his shoes, using the rabbit method. One ear goes up, the other ear lassoes that ear, slips under the loop and becomes the second ear. I taught him how to ride a bike, gently pushing from behind as he found confidence to press the pedals and gather speed. Now, on occasion, Sam pushes me in a wheelchair. On my end, no pedaling is required. When I rise carefully from the chair, my son often checks my laces before I take a step, and he's quick to tie them for me if needed. The only problem for my firstborn was a matter of timing. More consequential to his life than my still-developing Parkinson's disease was another timeline. Sam was born 3 years before I gave up drinking, a sobriety that I still maintain. Too much of our father-child pre-K quality time was Miller time. He tells me that his earliest memories include going to the fridge to get me beers. I can't recall my drinking ever putting Sam or Tracy in jeopardy, but my alcohol was an evolving problem. I had been adamant that we have a child early in our marriage, very much fixated on the archetypal husband/father. Any space between those two was too big a space. To be a husband and not a father didn't make sense to me. I'm sure Tracy conveyed reluctance or hesitation, but I failed to read her true feelings and to understand how severely maternity would disrupt her ascending career. There were repercussions to these first few faulty steps. We found ourselves on infirm ground. I was engaged as a dad and I loved my son, but in some ways I was only going through the motions of being a dad. For a sanguine adult as Sam is now, his early childhood was fraught with challenges. He was colicky and unusually glum for a child that young. I was a little help. Plus, I was drinking, and with news of my Parkinson's diagnosis, inner turmoil met outer tremulousness. Something I had to give. So, logically, my suggestion to Tracy was, we have another child. She shook her head incredulous. Are you joking? Her resistance had little to do with any theretofore unproven concerns about hereditary Parkinson's disease or my ability to function as a potentially disabled parent. Instead, it had everything to do with my drinking and my state of mind, which at the point was in survival mode. I was often traveling for work, but my isolation on the road was no more profound than my growing sense of isolation at home. I felt marginalized in a way, not understanding that I was the instrument of that detachment. I was moody, confused about the status of our marriage, the direction of my career, and given my recent diagnosis, the future existence of a career at all. Finally, after one particularly nasty night of drinking, I woke to find Tracy standing over me as I slept on the couch. I spilled beer on the carpet next to my draping arm. She took in the scene and simply asked me, "Is this what you want?" It wasn't anger in her voice that caused me right then and there to change my life forever. It was boredom. She scared the hell out of me. Tracy was so over this whole floor show. I committed to regularly attending a 12-step program, and I enlisted Joyce, a gifted Jungian analyst who helped me put out the fires that she would many more times throughout the years. Gradually, I learned to accept and understand my new illness. I could put down a drink, but Parkinson's would be with me for the rest of my life. The knowledge, tools, and counseling that the program provided also served to illuminate a path forward with my disease. I worked hard on not just becoming my old self again, but a newer, better version. 6 years after our wedding, 4 years after I learned that I had PD, 3 years after I got sober, I found that I developed a strengthened union with my extraordinarily patient, loving wife. And in that year, 1994, Tracy became pregnant with twins, an extra baby to make up for lost time, or maybe a wink from God. People felt strangely comfortable asking if we were concerned about bearing more children while dealing with the open-ended escalation of a major neurological disorder and the fear that the babies could inherit the disease. The question could be construed as inappropriate, but the answer was, we weren't concerned, nor should they be. Doubling down on doubling up. The twins were not playing nicely in utero. Tracy's labor was induced a month earlier than her due date because of a complication with the pregnancy. Twin-to-twin transfusion meant that one of the babies was dominating the food and blood supply, hogging the placenta and gaining weight while the other was gradually growing weaker. So we picked a date, thereby throwing the whole astrology thing into doubt. They were induced, and sure enough, baby number one debuted pale and wan, weighing about 4 pounds, followed 8 minutes later by baby number two, closer to 6 pounds, fat and red as a tomato, and I swear she was smiling. To this day, at 25 years of age, baby number one, Aquina, beautiful, funny, smart, not greedy or selfish, nevertheless is aware of what she needs and how to protect it. Of the two, she's the more independent and resolute. Baby number two, Skylar, also beautiful, they are twins, is bright, generous, and always willing to share. At times, she's more concerned for others than herself. I suspect she feels a modicum of guilt for being such a shitty womb mate. Aquina has forgiven her sister for trying to kill her. We don't get involved. It's between the sisters. However Parkinson's disease affected me during the early lives of Sam, Aquina, and Skylar, they absorbed it as normal. And something good was happening in our family. Because when it came to the decision to have yet another child, a fourth, we had no hesitation. Tracy and I recall our conversation. The girls' fifth birthday party had wrapped up and the guests had left. Exhausted, Tracy and I wallowed in the aftermath. Sipping a glass of wine while I nursed a Diet Coke, Tracy squinted at me and asked, "You know what I'm thinking?" "If I knew what you were thinking, my life would be so much easier," I truthfully replied. She laughed. "I just have this feeling like someone's not here yet." I gestured around the room. "Well, the party's over. We're out of goodie bags." Tracy clarified, sort of, "Our apartment isn't as noisy as it wants to be." We did the math, and it all added up to Esme. For Esme, Parkinson's has not only been a constant in her inner family life, but she has been alive through the emergence and growth of the Michael J. Fox Foundation as a force in medical research. She sees my public persona as that of a civil activist and a very available parent in semi-retirement. We couldn't have commissioned a more ideal child to be the last at home during the college diaspora years. One advantage gained by living with Esme's spirit is that she's clearly demonstrably been here before. She reads and writes with a proficiency that reveals a nuanced understanding for a person her age. So she'll come to us for advice. I don't let on to her, but I'm always humbled. She possesses an ease and facility with the strange and difficult. Nothing throws her, no person, no place, no predicament can discourage or distract her from her objective. We assumed Esme would follow in her siblings' footsteps and attend the same summer camp they had. Our youngest child, at age 8, kept her own counsel. She ruled out the camp the older kids attended, owing to the fact that she has peanut allergies, and her independent research uncovered that the old camp was not aware. Scouring the internet, she personally initiated contact with a number of goober-intolerant camps, with one in particular, Walt Whitman in New Hampshire, being her favorite. So that's where she went. I bet she appreciates Walt Whitman, the poet and optimist, too. That's Esme. Time travelers. Tracy and I have a theory about all of our kids. They are time machines. With cruel velocity, the energy of their very lives tumbles us forward in time. Birth, grade school, friends, celebrations, crises real and perceived, social media, high school, college, until we're suddenly sitting in an empty house with rooms full of teddy bears, rock and roll posters, generations of game systems, clothes that you can't throw away but won't be worn anymore, and girl shoes once jealously fought over now ready for discard. I wish away my time while I wait for my children to come and visit. Only my wife is wise enough to realize that this is a time for us, to slow it down, to find a rhythm. Strangely, I can relate Parkinson's to this. It's another way the disease has been a gift, albeit a gift that keeps on taking. The deliberation with which I approach each day, each second, each movement, each intention can literally slow me down to a crawl. All of those seconds, all of those minutes are considered. I have a mini conversation with myself about my every move. I'm taking my time. Time isn't taking me. Empty nest. Sam is more than 30 now. I don't know when or how it happened, but he's a fully functioning adult. My work pertaining to him is essentially done. Because the woman I fell in love with, his mother, has superior genes, I fulfilled the Darwinian goal of any father and co-created a taller, smarter, funnier, better-looking version of myself. I did not finish high school with my class of 1979, GED class of 93, so I didn't know how to relate to my oldest child as he left for college. I had no experiences to share, no pithy advice about co-eds, only cautionary tales from a few frat parties I'd crashed at UCLA during my early years as a starving actor in LA. Rule number one, keep track of your beer cup. It didn't seem real. No matter how many times I visited campuses with Sam and read over admission forms, I was still shocked when he actually left. I was also kind of pissed. Sam and I share a special bond, not just the stereotypical father-son stuff and beyond the usual relationship that exists between a parent and their oldest child. Ours has always been a connection of shared interests and ideas, stomping through the woods in Vermont and Connecticut, our mutual love of rock music, from Frank Zappa to Led Zeppelin to Jay-Z, and the wide-ranging political conversations which have found him surprisingly even to the left of me. Mostly we share an appreciation of the absurd. I refer you back to politics and Frank Zappa. Sam was my day-to-day guy, my buddy, my ride-or-die homie, and now he was gone. I know it was just a college, but still, he was absent. We prepare our children to go off to school, and then they have the nerve to actually leave. They come home for a couple of days, get their laundry done, and spend more time with their friends from high school than they do with us. It's torture, really. We're proud. We're worried. Concerned that they won't be able to get along without us, and then we're shattered when they do. We're left realizing that as they begin to create their own future, we begin to face our own mortality. As much as I love my wife and three daughters, after Sam headed to the West Coast, I was drowning in a sea of estrogen. I was feeling the need for a buddy that summer when I read a notice on the bulletin board of the Chilmark General Store on Martha's Vineyard. Chapter 2, Dog Years. The term rescue dog brings two images to mind. One is semi-comic, the cliched St. Bernard with the brandy cask dangling from his neck looking for alpine day trippers lost in snowdrifts. The other one reverses the rules. I'm thinking of those devastating images from ASPCA ads with Sarah McLachlan and Eric McCormick and those incredible folks who actually rescue dogs from excruciating pain and neglect. I admire them for their heartbreakingly difficult work. Otherwise, the use of the word rescue when applied to just doing something decent, like adopting a dog from a pound or from a neighbor who's moving, strikes me somewhat vainglorious. It just doesn't rise to the level of heroism. A reminder, we get something out of it, too. We get a dog, a friend, a confidant, and for me, another thing to trip over. Growing up as an Army brat, I never had a dog. Not that military service prohibits dog ownership, it's just that we moved around an awful lot, and to paraphrase an old axiom, if the Army wanted you to have a dog, they would have issued you one. As a young adult living on my own, I resumed a peripatetic lifestyle, frequently traveling for television and movie work. I did, however, welcome a few dogs into my life. Two dogs in particular stand out. One I met recently, close to home. The other crossed my path years ago, halfway around the world in Southeast Asia. For much of the first part of 1988, I was in Thailand, filming Casualties of War, a grueling, often lonely experience, even in the chaos of film production. Tracy and I were engaged to be married soon after my return to the States, and I missed her on a cellular level. One day in April, on location in a village called Phang Nga on the island of Phuket, I observed a family gathered by the beach. A small black and white puppy of indeterminable pedigree, a short rope leash dangling from his scruffy neck, romped around them. The family kept shooing him away. I'm a sucker for underdogs, literal and figurative. I crouched down and called him over. He bounced towards me as if he'd known me most of his life, which at this point he practically had. My driver, Wanchai, attempted to convince me that the puppy was not a pet but protein destined for the soup pot. Wanchai was probably taking the piss out of me, but it was true that the family didn't seem to be emotionally attached to the dog, at least in its current non-entree form. He wound up tagging along with me all day, and I decided that I wasn't going to leave him behind. I offered the family the Thai baht equivalent to 10 American dollars, and they accepted. It soon became obvious that my new friend was a pestilent mess. On my next day off, I brought him to a veterinarian on the island. After deworming, treating his mange, and riddling his body with a gamut of shots and vaccinations, the vet suggested I name him Sunuk, a Thai word on the order of peace or shalom, an expression of goodwill, spiritual and emotional. I liked it. Sunuk stayed with me all through the spring and summer, right up to the point where we finally wrapped our marathon production and departed Thailand for home. Sadly, there was no way I could subject Chinook to the prohibitive quarantine process involved in exporting an animal from Asia to the United States. Two other dogs were living at the Amanpuri Resort in Phuket, my base during filming. Both belonged to the hotel's manager, and the hounds tolerated Chinook as they would an exasperating kid brother. The little pup thrived there. Why wouldn't he? Swimming pool, palm shade trees, scraps in the kitchen. I appealed to the manager, who generously promised to take in Chinook. Back in the U.S., I married Tracy, and every now and then I'd think about that little black and white puppy. She would have loved him. A few years later, a friend mentioned that he had just vacationed at the Amanpuri in Thailand. "I met your dog," he reported. "You met my dog? A little black and white pup named Chinook? Is he okay?" "Yeah," he said. "He looks happy. Only they don't call him Chinook. I guess they gave him a new name." "What is it?" "Michael J. Fox." Gentle Giant. Gus was born in a shelter somewhere in the South. The litter of puppies was shuttled to another shelter in New England, where a very nice woman from Colorado adopted one of the males and took him to her family's summer home on Martha's Vineyard. She soon discovered an allergy to dog hair. Through an oddly serendipitous series of events, I met Gus and brought him to my own home. Some may deem this as a rescue, but I don't. I didn't rescue Gus. You can argue that he rescued me, but he'd be too modest to make that claim. Gus and I just found each other. Lucky Gus. Lucky me. The Chilmark store in Martha's Vineyard is a place to grab a slice of pizza or a cup of coffee and settle on the porch. On any day in season, a cross-section of the hordes of summer people gather there to shop, snack, and chat, and maybe see one or two of the famous folks who spend time on the island. The person you're reaching across to grab a straw at the condiment counter could be Jake Gyllenhaal or James Taylor or Larry David, although he might smack your hand away. This is definitely where the cool people hang out. I tend to avoid it. Not so much the store as the scene. My friend Clark Gregg, along with his wife Jennifer Gray and their daughter Stella, were vacationing with us. On the way home from playing golf, Clark suggested we pull into the Chilmark for a frozen coffee. I groaned. I wasn't in the mood to run across Alan Dershowitz holding court with his entourage, but it was a drippingly hot afternoon, and frozen coffee held appeal. We emerged, coffeed up, and stepped onto the porch. On the store's weathered shingle-clad wall, they have a bulletin board for people to post ads. Babysitting services, guitar lessons, yard work, upcoming concerts, and community events. Through the clutter, a photograph caught my eye. A puppy up for adoption. The ad described him as a 3-month-old black and white Great Dane Lab mix named Astro, after the dog in the Jetsons cartoons. I didn't say anything or take the number down, but I had Astro on my brain. That night at dinner, Tracy said to me, "I saw something interesting today on my bike ride. I stopped by the Chilmark store and there was an ad on the bulletin board." "For a dog? Astro?" I interrupted. She put down her fork. "Yeah, Astro the dog. How did you know?" "You saw it too? We gotta meet this dog." And then I added, "I hope he doesn't have the name Astro imprinted yet." Four-legged son. Life with Gus, nay Astro, is a revelation. Late summer 2008, I don't realize until Sam leaves and Gus shows up that I've gradually been paring away at the physical side of my life. I can't run in a safe, reliable way anymore, my leaping and jumping are suspect, and I'm a menace on the golf course. But I can still walk for days. Sam and I drifted away from doing anything much more physical than hiking, biking, and jumping in the pool. The latter, curiously, is the only thing Gus won't do. As much as he looks part retriever, his aversion to water clearly identifies him as a hound dog. Lazy, but game for anything except the pool. He has a similar negative reaction to the beach. He is restless, agitated, and he has a psychotic break anytime Tracy or I or one of the kids disappear into the waves. Waiting desperately for us to emerge, he paces a trench in the sand, emits low, soft yelps, and searches frantically for someone to help. "Anyone, anyone!" But he's not concerned enough to venture in himself. Eventually, we join him back on the beach and towel off and try to talk him down. I told you, he's not a rescue dog. Once back in the city, our days began early, with a 6:30 a.m. walk through Central Park. Still in shadows, the sun rising in the east, we patrol the horse trail surrounding the reservoir. When we reach the turn at the power station, the path straightens out towards the halfway point. The sun begins to find us and we quicken our steps. On the days when I can't make it to the park with Gus, the chore, although I wouldn't call it that, goes to a hired walker. The dog walkers in our neighborhood obviously work for the same company, and they're ubiquitous. About every other trip to the park, we ran into a dog that Gus knows, and that'd be a good 5 to 10 minutes of butt sniffing, tail wagging, and mock aggression, and me listening to a dog walker chat about grad school. For any dog lover, or simply any sentient human being, there is nothing quite like the energy of a puppy. It winds you up and wears you out at the same time. Still, guests can get worn out and want to take a rest on the west side. We'll do a lap around the great lawn and then park ourselves on the bench for Gus to receive his admirers. Everyone loves this dog. Tracy comments, "You know they're not stopping because of the dog. They're stopping to say hello to you." "No, you don't get it. I'm invisible. All they see is 40 pounds of 4-month-old black and white puppy, all ears and feet and tongue, and they fall in love instantly." After a sufficient period of adulation, we wend our way across Central Park West at 81st Street to drop in at the Bull Moose Dog Run on the north end of the Museum of Natural History. It is pure bedlam. Lots of dogs, lots of breeds, with lots of helicopter owners who should have calculated that bringing Precious to a dog park would likely result in encounters with other dogs. Gus, not to fault but by nature, is a madness multiplier. His energy and conviviality bring him into contact with everybody, two legs or four. This is where I have to play my secreted liver treats wisely. I need to bribe him to get him out of there. Usually a schnauzer or two comes around for a piece of the action. I shoo them away, wrestle the leash onto Gus's thick, meaty neck, and we are eastbound. Gus and I have regular times and regular routes, both in the city and around our neighborhood on Long Island. In less than a year, he grows from 40 pounds to 115 pounds. I don't have to bend an inch in order to rub his ears or scratch that spot between his eyes that he can't access. When I stop, he persistently headbutts my hand. He's so enormous now. Our neighbors, city and country, comment on the sight of the two of us. A small man walking a horse. I'd give a desiccated liver treat for every time I've heard, "Why don't you get a saddle for that thing?" Dog owners will recognize the relationship I'm describing. It's beyond owner-pet. It's an interspecies communion. I read somewhere and have proved it through actual practice that if you can maintain eye contact with an animal, especially a dog, for more than 30 seconds, a definite bond exists. Not to sound too creepy, but I can hold Gus's gaze for minutes on end. It's like he's awaiting instructions. He also responds to ridiculous verbal cues. "Gus," I'll suggest, "go grab your blanket." He'll bring me the brown one and I'll say, no, the red one. And he'll respond by fetching the correct color. There's a scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, one of my favorite films from one of my favorite directors, in which Brad Pitt returns home to his bull terrier and lectures to him while opening and preparing cans of dog food. It's not what he says to his canine roommate that stands out to me. It's the recognition of the relationship, the intimacy and respect that these two share. Spoiler alert, in the end, Brad's hero pit bull comes to the rescue and alters history. I'll have to screen that scene for Gus sometime. All of this is not to suggest that my relationship with Gus replaced or supplanted in some way with my relationship with my son. There's obviously no sane way to compare the two. But the ache that I felt when Sam went away was eased and extenuated by the completely different role that a great Danish mutt now plays in my life. He keeps me moving. He keeps me present. And in an important way, he keeps me honest. Chapter 3, Act 2. As an actor, here's how I see myself. I can portray any human being, and some animals, as long as they have Parkinson's disease. My character on Spin City, Deputy Mayor Michael Flaherty, didn't have PD, so by the end of our second season, it was difficult for him to believably pass as physically uncompromised. Increasingly worried that my random movements would confuse the audience if they didn't know about my disease, and alienate them if they did, would they still think I'm funny if they knew I had PD? I chose to publicly disclose my condition in 1998. Indeed, the fans were accepting and supportive, but by 2000, after much deliberation, I made the decision to retire from the show and from show business. At age 40, my symptoms had advanced to a point that I deemed career-ending. In retrospect, I may have jumped the gun. My situation was evolving in unexpected ways. Whereas during my last season on Spin City, I was tremoring and swaying with dyskinesias, the next couple of years of voluntary unemployment brought relief from some of the harsher PD symptoms. I found a movement disorder specialist, Dr. Susan Bressman, who completely reconfigured my pharmaceutical approach towards treating Parkinson's. She also put an emphasis on physical therapy, diet, and fitness. This period was restorative, less stressful, and allowed me to get a better grip on the disease. Responsibilities with the Fox Foundation kept me constructively occupied during this time, and of course I had a dynamic family life with a wife and four school-aged kids. I was happy as a clam. But who wants to be a clam? I felt it was way too much me time. I wanted to be somebody else, at least for a few hours. After 2 years of retirement, the idea of acting again seemed more and more plausible, and maybe even necessary. As if he had a direct line to my brain, my friend and Spin City co-creator Bill Lawrence called. He had a new show called Scrubs, a medical comedy set in a dysfunctional hospital, with a hysterical cast led by Zach Braff. Billy wanted to know if I felt up to doing an arc, a guest role that plays out over a few episodes. I was interested, although I had a few concerns. I issued a fair warning. I hate to be a diva, but you know I come with baggage. And when I say baggage, I mean two rolls, a hat box, and a garment bag. And a fanny pack, I bet, Billy ventured. What do you need, longer breaks, later call times? All that and more, I promise. It was an interesting opportunity. The character Billy had in mind was Dr. Kevin Casey, an eccentric neurosurgeon with obsessive-compulsive disorder. The character was written with all of the classic OCD behaviors, hand-washing, light-switching, vocal tics, but I wouldn't focus on those. To me, they didn't represent the full person. I had to find Kevin's truth. It's not what a character reveals, it's what he's hiding that's intriguing. I didn't have to search too deeply to find a point of connection with Dr. Kevin Casey. He met me where I was. The scene opens. J.D. confronts Dr. Casey in the surgical scrub area where he's washing his hands. J.D. forcefully. Kevin, I have to talk to you right now. This interrupts Casey's thorough hand cleaning. He shuts off the faucet with his elbow and turns on J.D. Damn it! J.D. suddenly losing his bravado. Later's cool, too. Dr. Casey, I spent the last few days meeting new people and trying to get used to this place. I'm stressed and I'm fried and I just want to go home. But here's the punchline. Even though my last surgery was 2 hours ago, I can't stop washing my damn hands. Casey screams with frustration and throws the soap across the room. J.D., I'm sorry. Dr. Casey, no, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. This is a weak moment. Nobody's supposed to see this. He takes a beat. I'll clean up the soap probably several thousand times. Everyone's got their own burdens, J.D., and I'm not going to be one of those people who dumps mine on somebody else. Now, what do you need? J.D., nothing. J.D. studies Dr. Casey. The scene dissolves into montage. Dr. Casey going through his end-of-day rituals, co-plays Everything's Not Lost accompanies. J.D., interior voiceover. I think owning your burdens is half the battle. Still, it's not that daunting if you look around and see what other people have to deal with. Scene closes. My two episodes on Scrubs provided a test of sorts, and in my humble opinion, I think I passed. I didn't present the audience with the character who had Parkinson's disease, but one with OCD. I discovered I could focus less on the externals and stop trying to hide my symptoms. This was in stark relief from my days on Spin City, when I'd keep a live audience waiting while I paced my dressing room, pounding my arm with my fist in a vain attempt to quell the tremors. On Scrubs, instead of trying to kill it, I invited Parkinson's with me onto the set. I felt free to concentrate on what any actor, able-bodied or not, is charged with accomplishing, uncovering the internal life of another human being. Putting the emphasis on my character's vulnerabilities and not my own, Parkinson's could in fact disappear and be morphed into whatever my character was living with. My inability to still my hands echoed Dr. Casey's inability to cease scrubbing his own. As for his vocal tics and repetitions, I could find a version of that pattern from my own experience. And the slower pace in my stride transformed into his hesitation when walking into a new environment. It became about who he was, and not what he had. Moreover, not what I had. I began thinking more broadly about what possibilities my future could hold. Suddenly, I was open for business again. Instead of allowing my idiopathy to deter me from employment, I created a new blueprint for myself. How to be a working actor with a disability. I'd co-opt the disease, get PD to do a little acting of its own, and bring my Parkinson's into the family business. There had been previous inquiries about my willingness and availability to work, and other guest role offers before Bill Lawrence reached out. Not wanting to set myself up for failure, I had demurred. But I gained a lot from those 2 weeks on Scrubs. I realized that we all have our burdens. Every character has a bear inside that they're wrestling with, no matter where they are and what they're doing. As an actor, I suddenly wanted more opportunities to take on that bear. So yes, I was right. I can play anyone, as long as they have Parkinson's. And as I was discovering, everyone has Parkinson's. Please come to Boston. I am billionaire businessman Daniel Post, on a date with attorney Denise Bauer, Julie Bowen. Flirting, laughing, we discuss the evening's further possibilities. It's a sexy scene, and things will only heat up from here. We're filming a night location shoot for Boston Legal, a well-crafted legal drama infused with David E. Kelly's wry sense of humor. Julie Bowen's brilliance and generosity as an actor make me feel secure, yet she keeps me on my toes. Daniel Post has stage 4 cancer. Enter from the shadows, the bear. Daniel's billions are of no use to him. The writers masterfully set up the conflict of a doomed man with more fortune than future. They also include scenes where I'm required to be romantically intimate. I only mention this because of the physical confidence it takes to perform these scenes in particular. I don't want to wrap my arms around the leading lady and shake her like a martini. For me professionally, Boston Legal was an ideal follow-up to Scrubs. After we wrap production, what I remember most from that first night is the smell of carbon in the air, emanating from the Ark, the huge movable Klieg light that illuminated the sidewalk. It smelled like show business. I was working, and I loved it. It all combined to set me up for an Emmy nomination. A nice surprise, and a great honor. The next decade plus would play out in unexpected and deeply gratifying ways. Keeping an active schedule, I applied myself to the work of the Fox Foundation. It amazed me what we've been able to accomplish in a short amount of time. Our team created a forceful presence in philanthropic research, and the organization quickly grew to serve the needs of many, patients, families, and the scientists we fund. During this period, I also wrote a few books and somehow nurtured the second act of my career. Each acting offer came with the opportunity to play an interesting character. That was the cool thing. They were characters. Somewhere, somehow, between Spin City and Boston Legal, I had become a character actor. I can think of no higher calling for a thespian. Some of my all-time favorite supporting performers include Edward G. Robinson, Thelma Ritter, Strother Martin, Jack Warden, and a contemporary I've worked with, John C. Reilly. When I first moved to L.A. and joined the Screen Actors Guild, I changed my professional name as a nod to another favorite character actor, Michael J. Pollard. There's a consistency in the best work of Pollard and all these others, a fluidity and integrity. Free of the onus of carrying the story, they can explore the idiosyncratic and even the extreme. I didn't miss being the leading man. I think of that Hollywood truism that explains the difference between a short actor and a short movie star. To appear taller in a shot, a short actor stands on a box, while a short movie star has everyone else stand in a ditch. I discovered the simple pleasures of the ditch, where vanity has no value. Tommy, Dennis, Dwight, and me. Another old friend of mine with a wire to my brain, actor, writer, producer Dennis Leary, is one of the great wild cards in my life, and one of the most creative and prolific writers I know. So when he called me with an offer to do a few episodes of his hit series, Rescue Me, I was listening. Fox, you gotta do my show. Keep talking, I said. Who's the guy? Dwight, the boyfriend of my ex-wife. He's nuts. A bitter, angry, lonely, pill-popping, alcoholic, sarcastic, sex-addicted shithead. And oh, he's a paraplegic. This was a lot to take in. Dennis, I asked, what part of this guy made you sit up and say, let's call Mike Fox? Never mind all that other stuff. How am I supposed to play paralyzed? You realize I can't stop moving. This guy's in a wheelchair and I'm a human whirligig. Yeah, Dennis said. You'll figure it out. One of my favorite scenes out of my 5 Rescue Me episodes established the animosity between Dwight and Dennis's character, Tommy. Mid-argument, with his wheelchair folded and leaning against the wall, inaccessible, Dwight throws himself from the couch to the floor and commando crawls towards Tommy, who retreats as Dwight howls epithets. In the aftermath of the fracas, Dwight cracks a vulgar joke to himself, followed by a rueful laugh as he exults in the chaos. Somehow, a fragile truce is established between the two, and Dwight invites Tommy to go for a ride in his supercharged convertible muscle car with hand-controlled throttle, brake, clutch, and gear shift. The other element of some importance, Dwight is high on pills, sopping drunk, and whenever he inexplicably has a free hand, he chug-a-lugs from the beer can wedged between his seat and the console, all the while bragging about his sexual prowess with Tommy's ex-wife. A wild ride, even the film crew was terrified. Alex Keaton, we hardly knew ye. It was one of my favorite roles of my career, and this time, I won the Emmy. Thanks, Rescue Me. Thanks, Dennis. It's personal. Larry David had an idea that, not surprisingly, sounded hysterically funny, totally irreverent, and potentially offensive. I knew that Curb Your Enthusiasm was largely improvised, with narrative objectives established by the writers and producers, and prompts to help performers advance the plotline. So instead of sending me a script, Larry pitched me the story. I moved to New York, he said, to get out of this charity thing in Los Angeles. And one night at a restaurant, I see you, Michael J. Fox, you, and a couple of friends having a drink. I kind of give a hello hand signal, and you shake me off. I shake you off? How do I do that, I ask. With your head, the way you move your head seems judgmental. Wait, do you think I'm judging you with my head? Yeah, I'm offended by the way you shake your head, in judgment. You know that's the Parkinson's. Yeah, well, I take it personally. I have to laugh. Nice. Larry continued with what was becoming the most ridiculously funny pitch ever. Then one night I'm in my new apartment, and my upstairs neighbor is really annoying, stomping around and making a lot of noise. So I go upstairs to confront him, and I find that it's you. Now I'm convinced that you're faking Parkinson's just to piss me off. I lean in and give you the big eyeball, the look I give to people I don't trust. I giggle. I love the eyeball. So you invite me in, try to calm me down. I watch you. I know I'm going to catch you with something. You offer me a drink and grab a Diet Coke from the fridge. All the way to the table, your hand is shaking. So when I open the soda, it explodes in my face, and the feud escalates from there. What Larry was suggesting really pushed it to the edge. I suppose it could have been a disaster if people, especially PD patients and their families, mistook my openness for self-ridicule. But I saw it as liberating. After all those years of hiding my symptoms, sometimes over-medicating to achieve and maintain kinetic neutrality, I could let it go. After Larry's pitch, I not only wanted to be in the show, I couldn't wait to watch it. The Good Ride. I follow Tracy's footprints in the sand from the shore break until I reach her on the towel where she sits, glistening in the sun and wringing the seawater out of her hair. I collapse into a wooden canvas beach chair, an instrument of torture, and I try to get comfortable. This is when the lady approaches. I don't know her. I haven't seen her on the beach before. "Mr. Fox," she says, looking me in the eye with a seriousness that seems incongruous with the setting. "I have to make a confession to you." Not exactly the words you want to hear from a stranger. Now she had Tracy's attention, too. "Watching you walk down to the water with your wife, I get this feeling of revulsion, hatred, and loathing. I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized, you're Lewis Canning. You are despicable." I laugh and say, "I'm flattered." Lewis Canning definitely made an impression. This was the big surprise of my post-career career. The guest role on The Good Wife that turned into a 26-episode run over 4 seasons. The writer-producers, Robert and Michelle King, called to offer me a short arc during the show's sophomore season. Part of a lawyer, disabled and wheelchair-bound. Coming off Rescue Me, I didn't think it was a good idea to repeat myself. So we compromised. Tardive dyskinesia, a disorder featuring symptoms in common with Parkinson's, is the disability we bestowed upon Lewis Canning, equity partner and lead litigator in the firm Canning & Myers. Lewis tremored less than if he'd had Parkinson's, but he had similar problems with balance, gait, and sometimes speech. Sort of large motor, slow motion spasticity. Not ideal for a high-powered litigator. Within weeks, I'm working on a courtroom set in a makeshift studio in Brooklyn. My character introduces himself to a group of prospective jurors during the voir dire process of jury selection. "Lewis, before I ask you just a few questions, I probably owe you an explanation. This movement you see, this, you probably noticed that, huh?" Some chuckles, laughs as he studies the jurors, walking up and down the line, seeing who meets his eye and who doesn't. Lewis continues, "I suffer from tardive dyskinesia. That's a funny word for a neurological syndrome. It makes me do this," making fun of himself. "Ah!" More chuckles. "If you just look at me long enough, you'll get used to it. Go ahead, look, I don't mind." Lewis goes on to tell the jury that when his symptoms worsen, he relies on medication, a vial of which he conveniently produces from his breast pocket and waves before the potential jurors. The case he's about to defend is on behalf of a pharmaceutical company accused of manufacturing tainted pills. Unlike Rescue Me's Dwight, who soaks in his misery, the Good Wife writers created a character who shamelessly exploits his own misfortune, converting it into an asset to win sympathy and jury votes. This was twisted fun for me on 2 levels. I got to play a guy who took the worst part of his life and turned it into the best part of his work. He used his disability to extract empathy and goodwill in pursuit of victory. Level 2, disabled and differently abled characters are always seen in a sympathetic light, soft piano music rising to a crescendo as they achieve their relatively modest goals. This guy was different. He was debilitated, but no piano. He was an asshole. It's easy to dismiss Lewis Canning as a manipulative jerk, but he's more complicated than that. He exploits his handicap to induce sympathy and goodwill with jurors, which on its face is unethical and inappropriate. But I think there's something else in play. I know from experience that people have an aversion to anyone who moves differently. Lewis Canning succeeded in preempting that reaction by projecting a friendly and forthcoming demeanor. With the writing on the show so good and Lewis so well conceived, even Parkinson's couldn't screw it up. One of my reasons for leaving Spin City was that I felt my face was no longer as expressive as I needed it to be. I'd always liked being an actor that editors could cut to at any time for an appropriate reaction, my face always alive in a scene. Whether speaking or not, my character would be animated and engaged. Gradually, with the effects of Parkinson's, my face began retreating to a passive, almost frozen disposition. It was blank, and I was hard-pressed to enliven it in any way that didn't seem artificial. Acting is what I do, and I needed to find a new way to do it. Instead of focusing on the notes I could no longer hit, I'd focus on my new instrument. It's not an electric, it's an acoustic. It's not a Les Paul, it's a hummingbird. Ultimately, I found that the philosophy of less is more works for me, which is convenient because I have less. But as I discovered, there's more to less than I thought. Lewis Canning taught me that I could utilize my blank expression and employ it as his inscrutable, enigmatic persona. My absence became his attitude, my deficit his asset. The array of characters I embodied in my second career all had something in common. All were overachievers. Dwight was no exception. All were passionate. All had a flaw that was relatable to my own. Each had a vulnerability and a corresponding point of damage. Add a dash of humor to that pathos, and I've done a day's work. Forgive the mention, but these shows, post-retirement, led me to 8 Emmy nominations. Actually, it was 9, one more as a producer, with my partner Nell Fortenberry, for a documentary we filmed in Central Asia. Every bit as remarkable a journey as the professional one I was in the midst of experiencing. Chapter 4, High Times. After a long flight to Frankfurt and a 7-hour layover in Delhi, we make a quick stop in Kathmandu, Nepal, to drop off and pick up passengers. I'm hearing Bob Seger's Kathmandu on my inner iPod as we gain altitude. Stunning vistas beguile me, and soon the view will be supersized. Apparently not bound by post-9/11 FAA standards, the Druk Air pilots invite me to join them in the cockpit for the last leg of the trip. They strap me into the jump seat and continue the climb into the thin blue ether. I fall into silent reverie at the majesty of Mount Everest out the cockpit window. But the pilots want to talk movies and television, thrilled to have Marty McFly peering over their shoulders for the hour-long flight. Though I'm happy to indulge my hosts, I worry that my showbiz small talk will distract this pair of 20-something aviators. I'd learn later that the facts flew literally in the face of my ageism. These guys are expert pilots, part of a small elite group who are specifically trained and certified to land at the airport in Paro. Flying over the Himalayas is like house-sitting for God. Until our sudden close encounter with the massive white wall of death, the sheer icy edifice of a Himalayan peak, a last-minute 90-degree right turn kicks up a swirl of glacial crystals, and we execute a precipitous, gut-wrenching dive to an abbreviated runway. The young pilot is as calm as a soccer mom driving a minivan through a Walmart parking lot. After a shockingly abrupt but smooth landing, we are safe. We have touched down in the mysterious, miraculous kingdom of Bhutan. Some call it Shangri-La. While Bhutan, the country and its people, welcome us, they do require that we jump through hoops and sideswipe a few mountains in order to be their guests. Hey, if it was easy, everybody would be here. It's the spring of 2009. My producing partner, Nell Fortenberry, and I, along with our small documentary film crew, have flown to the top of the world to film a network television special. Nell and I have worked together since the first season of Spin City. Talented and unflappable as she is, the challenge of this project doesn't intimidate her or dampen her appreciation for this journey. Nell's expertise, along with that of our other executive producer, Rudy Bednar, assures that the work will be done. Also part of my team is my steadfast assistant, Nina Tringali. Trustworthy in any situation, she's smart, intuitive, and vigilant. At 5'10", she literally watches over me. The project serves as a documentary companion to my second book, Always Looking Up, adopting its subtitle, The Adventures of an Incurable Optimist, as the name of the program. We conceived it as an exploration of the power of optimism in my life and elsewhere. Through supplemental investigations, more curious than scientific, we spotlight those whose optimistic worldview has positively affected others. From an average New Yorker who doles out newspapers and a gleeful affirmation each morning at an Upper West Side subway station, to musicians who offer uplifting lyrics, to sports stars who don't let defeat defeat them, to the Chicago Cubs, at the time still amid a 100-year drought keeping them from a World Series title, but whose players and loyal fans continue to believe in the promise of each new season. Which brings us to the Kingdom of Bhutan. You've never heard of it? You're not alone. This small nation is located at the eastern end of the Himalayas in South Asia. It is bordered to the east and south by India, to the north by the Tibet Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China, and to the west it is separated from Nepal by the Indian state of Sikkim. Agriculture, forestry, and tourism are the pillars of Bhutan's economy. Its major source of revenue is the sale of hydroelectric power to India. Relatively few tourists are adventurous enough to visit Bhutan, but those who do appreciate the handicrafts, weaving, and religious art that people produce. There's a daily fee for each visitor, as much as $500 per day, and mandatory accompaniment by a government-assigned guide. The kingdom has no railroads. A challenging landscape that varies from hilly to ruggedly mountainous has made the building of roads and other infrastructure difficult and expensive. They definitely save money on airport runways. If you're happy and you know it. Bhutan's forbidding topography and landlocked status hinders the country's trade with other nations. Not that Bhutan regards trade in traditional terms. While it does measure its GNP, gross national product, it is the GNH, gross national happiness, that is of greater importance to its people, government, and king. Bhutan is the only country known to measure happiness by this metric. Key to the concept, its parliament is determined to preserve the nation's traditional culture and identity, and to avoid destruction of the environment. Accordingly, Bhutan has been rated the happiest country in Asia, and is a perennial contender for the happiest country in the world, according to a global survey conducted by the University of Leicester. When the government lifted a ban on television and the internet in 1999, Bhutan became one of the last countries to introduce television. This was the same year I retired from Spin City. Coincidence? In weighing isolation versus careful progress, the king chose to lead the people toward the future. Citing in his proclamation speech, "Television is a critical step to the modernization of Bhutan, as well as a major contributor to the country's gross national happiness." Personally, I saw very little Bhutanese television, just snippets of CNN and International in the hotel room. I don't think they're binging. A kingdom of fiercely loyal and loving subjects, the people voiced rare opposition to King Jingmei Singye Wenchuk when he established a constitutional democracy over the traditional one-person rule. People accepted it, but still behaved as if Bhutan were a pure monarchy. In 2006, he abdicated the throne peacefully and lovingly to his son, Jigme Khesar Namgyal Wenchuk, who commands the same reverential regard from the people, despite his young age. Just 25 when he ascended to the throne, he became the youngest reigning monarch and head of state in the world's newest democracy. Almost to a person, every Bhutanese man or woman that I meet refers to him reverentially as my king. At the airport in Paro, if the customs and immigration officers are grossly happy, it's not evident. They are taciturn, efficient, and brusque. Having offered satisfactory answers to their questions, we are allowed to proceed to the baggage area and then out to our waiting cars, where our drivers are happy as advertised. They take us from Paro, the flattest part of the country, hence the placement of the airport, to the capital city of Thimphu, along a route that traces the bends and turns of the Paro River Valley. Much of the country remains inaccessible for those without a specific purpose and an extraordinary determination to get from point A to point B. At first glance, the Paro area had impressed me as rustic and rugged, whereas our arrival in Thimphu finds us in a charming Asian mini-metropolis. Almost all of its citizenry adhere to a dress code. Women in traditional kiras, long aprons covered by fashionable jackets called tegos, and men in knee-length robes or goes. For official business, their outfits are adorned by scarves differentiated in color and style to signify rank and affiliation. Like its populace, each building in Thimphu, every bit of signage, is an expression of the nation's culture. In the town's main intersection, where one might expect to see a traffic signal, there's a uniformed officer ensconced in a tremendously ornate kiosk, orchestrating the flow of humans and vehicles. Thimphu is the only capital city in the world without a single traffic light. We check into our hotel, which surprisingly features all the mod cons. The rooms are spacious and the food tasty. My only complaint would be the number of dogs incessantly barking as they wander the streets around the hotel. Are they happy barks? I can't tell. Whoever let the dogs out eventually lets them back in. Everyone in our group reports a good night's sleep. Important because we have a busy day of filming ahead. First off, we aim to get a handle on what the Bhutanese are talking about when they reference GNH. Since we are in the nation's seat of government, we're able to gain rare access to the impressive array of parliament buildings. For our documentary, I interviewed Dasho Karma Tichim, formerly the Secretary of Bhutan's Planning Commission. This state organization was recently rebranded, giving Mr. Tichim the grand title Secretary of Gross National Happiness. This nomenclature is the king's way of prodding government planners to apply the principles of GNH to Bhutan's economic challenges. Mr. Tichim's job is to figure out how to boost morale as this long-isolated country hurtles towards modernization. He says that the concept of GNH has forced him to think more broadly about what adds to and subtracts from a person's well-being, and how that affects the national mood. Trusting government is important. Leisure time is important. For psychological well-being to flourish, all the other domains are important. He notes that once you cross a certain threshold, money doesn't get you more happiness. Our main concern is that if you have growth, which is blind, fed by people's growing consumption, it's not really sustainable. What we were trying to do in our own little context is see what pattern of growth will be sustainable and desirable. Fellow traveler. The secretary introduces me to another government minister, a 40-ish gentleman who has been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Not part of the official agenda, this is a casual meeting in a small room off the main corridor, away from the cameras. This quiet, thoughtful man, elegant in his go, obviously weighed discretion against the opportunity to speak to me on a patient-to-patient basis. His symptoms are not especially dramatic, but feature a left-hand tremor and a subtle slowness of speech and movement, or bradykinesia. Apparently his progression to this point has been fairly steady. We talk about medication and treatment in our respective countries. He discloses that even in his position, he has limited access to PD drugs beyond the basic levodopa. Then, as often happens, when speaking with fellow Parkinson's patients, the conversation relaxes into a give and take about our real-life stories. He has disclosed his condition only to a trusted few. He is as concerned about his future as would be any newly diagnosed Parkinson's patient. I lived in that state of trepidation and isolation for the first few years of my own life with PD. And here on the far side of the planet, this gentleman expresses the same experience. Disease has a way of connecting us. Moreover, we have another malady in common. Golf. The minister points out that Bhutan is especially proud of their one golf course, and he encourages me to at least go to the driving range. Due to the elevation in the Himalayas and the thinness of the air, the ball travels extraordinary distances. Alas, I haven't the time. Although it would be a radical improvement to my game. If not my long drives, then surely my putting would be a little steadier. Stirred but not shaking. Something unexpected and magical has developed since I arrived in Bhutan. My Parkinson's symptoms have lessened to the point where they are barely noticeable, not only to others, but to my own inner gyroscope. I have to remind myself to take my meds. As there is little need, I take less than prescribed. Surprisingly, it has taken me a full day to acknowledge what is happening. I keep quiet about my observations at first, and when speaking with the minister, I choose discretion. What's happening for me is not happening for him. This is intriguing. Is it emotional? Chemical? Is it spiritual, a period of grace? Parkies are notoriously prone to placebo effects. If that's what this is, then toss me another sugar pill. I feel renewed. Could it be a reaction to the altitude? We are above 7,600 feet. Or the interaction of the altitude sickness meds with my own? Or is it just a very palpable sense of contentment, ease, and zenned out bliss? Although I'm not a Buddhist or a subscriber to any particular orthodoxy, while in Bhutan, I happily and respectfully observe a number of Buddhist conventions and rituals, such as spinning prayer wheels and maintaining meditative silence while visiting temples and shrines. You'd expect that adhering to these unfamiliar codes would seem awkward and perfunctory, but it doesn't. My behavior simply acknowledges that I am in an entirely different place, having a unique experience, and possibly transforming and changing on a molecular level. I can't believe how normal I feel, given how abnormal the moment. The decrease in symptoms, tremor, bradykinesia, and the Parkinsonian gait is a puzzle. When I'm back in the States under ordinary circumstances, my symptoms don't come on suddenly. I'll be feeling fine, and then the meds will begin to wear off. There are a subtle series of tics, aches, and tremors, physical clues that tell me it's time for another round of pharmaceuticals. I ignore them at my peril. When symptoms arrive, they punish my inattention. But not so here up in the mountain kingdom. What mild warnings I receive never seem to fully develop. Rather than jump up and down with glee, I simply accept it, with gratitude. I medicate perfunctorily just so my body doesn't react negatively to a deficit, but it hardly seems necessary. Having Parkinson's is being in constant flux, in and out, on and off. Every reaction to the drugs is met with an equal and opposite reaction when they wear off. So you're constantly trying to keep your foot on the cat's tail until your toe starts tapping, and then the cat gets loose, and then you have to chase it down all over again. That feeling is absent in Bhutan. There's no on and off. Postcard from Punaka. We leave Thimphu early the next morning, a low mist hanging over the surrounding hills. Our vehicles trailed for a while by the ubiquitous yapping dogs. During one day's travel from the capital city of Thimphu to the Punaka Valley, we'll traverse three temperate zones. We slog through mud on switchback roads. Commercial trucks passing with mere inches of sloppy red dirt between safe